It's Great Mondays Radio. I'm Josh Levine, your host, founder of Great Mondays. We help executives from hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations build cultures that attract, engage, and retain top talent. If you'd like to be a guest on our program, hang out for about 20 minutes and I'll tell you how. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to Great Mondays Radio. Today, my guest is Samantha Stillwell. She is a culture consultant with Culture Dynamic. And interestingly, the reason why I'm having her on is because she brings together neurology and anthropology to understand how we understand ourselves, our work, and to improve the way that we work together. Welcome to the startup anthropologist on TikTok, Samantha Stillwell. Samantha, thanks for coming on Great Mondays Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's so good to be here. This is fun. I'm excited.
Yeah. So I love this idea of startup anthropologist. And I always think about like the tensions and the unexpected combination of concepts. And anthropology is not something that you typically think about or one typically thinks about in business. Can you give me a little bit of like your background? Like, how did you get interested in anthropology? And then why are you bringing it to business? Where did that come from?
Yeah, appreciate this question. It's really a non-traditional, I guess, trajectory, if you will.
They all end up being that way. Let's not pretend.
Yeah. anthropology. So I got into it because I'd originally wanted to do professional photography. And then I had a professor in college who told me that in order to do professional photography in university, I would really have to be producing art that the university wanted. And I quickly realized that this passion of mine would very quickly disappear if I was being forced to produce art that didn't align with what I wanted. So suddenly I found myself in a situation of saying, I really want to do an undergrad. I have no idea what I want to do it in. Like, what do I do? And so as one does, I went and talked to my older sister who was, you know, a pure academic. And I said, what should I do? And sought out her advice. And her question to me was there a course in college that you took that you genuinely loved and that you felt really connected to? And I, as it turns out, had taken an anthropology 101 or like an intro to anthropology course. And it was 8:30 a.m., the basement of the school, like, you know, everything was set up for you to hate it. And I was there ready to go, completely engaged, like, you know, full blown, this is what I want to do. And so it just clicked really instantly. And so I looked at schools in Canada that had good anthropology programs. UBC had, so the one out in British Columbia had the best anthropology program at the time in Canada. And so I said, why not put all of my eggs into one basket, as I do quite often in life, applied to the anthropology program, took a year off to kind of get my ducks in a row, got accepted there, moved out to BC. And I mean, it's just been an absolute love letter, I think, ever since. It really aligned with, it gave me all of the theoretical stuff to explain how I was already experiencing life around me and the questions I was already asking. Mm-hmm. In terms of the second part of your question, how it relates to business. So this was really a personal decision where I said, once I graduate with this degree, oftentimes the Bachelor of Arts degrees end up collecting dust on a shelf. I think most people are hard pressed to find a way to make a good living out of their undergrads when they do an arts degree. And then you take anthropology into the mix, and oftentimes you need to be doing graduate studies of some kind in order to Yep. really be working as a professional anthropologist right off the bat. And I didn't want to do either of those options. So I said, what else can I do that allows me to leverage anthropology and this passion I have while also making a living for myself and starting my career? And so that's where I started to look into startups and how they use this clickbait word culture all the time without fully understanding what is culture and never truly defining it for themselves or their business. And I realized there was this huge niche for me to come in and really help change the way we talk about culture and leverage that background to help people bring new insights into their workplace.
Right. Okay. So that's your definition of business anthropology. I think pretty good for where we want to start. Yeah. So what is it that you have learned that we should know, that other people need to know when they're thinking about culture in their business, startup or not? Mm-hmm. And and distinguish, I think, and it doesn't have to be immediate, but one of the questions that I want to get to is me as an individual, right? So your experience of understanding the world through anthropology. Mm-hmm. So your kind of business anthropology approach as an individual, like how can I use this as an individual contributor or manager of a small team versus founder, leader, you know, HR professional. So talk to us about like what you learned and what you want more people to know about thinking about anthropology, neurology, and the way that we work.
Yeah. All great questions. And I'll try to answer them as succinctly as possible. And I also, shameless plug, built a course, or I'm building a course around this to really deep dive into it. But the big, if I were to like really, really zoom out, ultimately, I think the thing that people forget about the most when we speak about culture, and this is where the anthropology side comes in, is that culture really is a collection of different things that form or in that kind of tell us how to behave or what attitudes to take on in any given environment. So at the very base, the culture of your workplace is what are the values, what are the processes, what are all the structures, policies, like all of these different things in place that indicate to somebody how they're expected to behave in order to be considered part of this community, and what are the attitudes they're expected to have in order to maintain that place in the community, right? Because if you're looking at a social culture, for example, and you're looking really outside of the workplace where anthropology spends a lot of its time, ultimately, your whole goal as a human being, as part of that desire to evolve and to survive, which is our ultimate goal as humans, is to maintain some kind of membership in a community, because that's how we get protected. We don't have hard shells like certain animals. We don't have poison in wings. We don't have like all of these different things, the ability to camouflage, right? And so our source of protection and survival is our community. And so it's the same thing in the workplace now. We've, you know, with the industrial era and everything, we've moved away from the traditional forms of survival. And so now our survival is having this membership in a place of work, because in the majority of cultures, your work and your profession is directly tied to your identity and the value that you have in society. As sad as that is, that's, you know, a reality.
That's the reality of it. It is. So, okay. So we're talking about, we inherently as humans, and I'm just going to kind of repeat back what I think I heard.
Yeah.
We inherently as humans are motivated to become part of the community. And it's why it's so painful when we are ostracized or don't fit in. And so whether we intend to or not, we are hyper aware of the cues that enable us to behave in a certain way. And when we talk about success or succeeding in a company, we're actually talking about being accepted. And if that aligns with I guess this is the next thing that I'm thinking about. My brain's going a million miles an hour. Which is why I wanted to have you on, because the first time we talked, I was like, oh my gosh. So it's interesting, because it's like sometimes those cultural norms inside of a company are at odds with the success of the company. And so how do you determine how do you determine if there's a misalignment there?
Yeah. So I guess this is where the neurology part can come in, is that if there are not clear rules and guidelines for how you're expected to behave and what attitudes you're expected to take on in order to have membership, then what your brain goes and does is unconsciously it relies on its own filters. And then those filters create these biases to start indicating to you how you're supposed to be behaving. And so if we don't have it clearly defined for us, and that's why I put so much emphasis on, as a workplace, the most important thing that you can do for your employees is to just very clearly say, this is what we value. This is how we make decisions. This is what consequences are for certain actions. Like, it seems really intense to lay all of that out, but if you don't do that, then our brains unconsciously fall back on our native filters that tell us how we can, you know, belong the most or find that belonging within our local environment. The issue with that is that we all come with very different filters depending on where we were raised, who raised us, what era we were raised in, right? There's all of these different things.
Yeah.
And so now we start to behave and it creates this gap that's further and further from the company. So in answer to your question around, you know, how do you find that fit and everything, it's ultimately being able to firstly, you know, as the, I forget which philosopher who said this, but the concept of like knowing thyself, right? It's it's understanding what your base is and where you're coming from. And then going into that company, whether it's through an interview, it could be in your onboarding, maybe you've been at the company for a long time, but you finally get to know who you are as a person, and going to these leaders in the company to say, hey, this is how I make decisions, or this is how I communicate things, or this is how I handle conflict. Where does the company stand on these things? And very quickly, you start to figure out, okay, is there an alignment between how I'm comfortable doing things and how the company expects me to do things? And then you get to make that decision to say, is it, am I comfortable changing that in order to maintain my membership in this community? Or do I feel like this compromises my values and my ethics, in which case I need to self-deselect from this community and go and find another one that aligns better?
Okay, so now we're getting into that second question that I asked up front, which is, how do I understand this from an individual point of view versus a leader point of view? And so the individual point of view, right, so know thyself. I feel like you're never there. You're always working on it. And that's something that we should do. How do we understand? I'm sure there's a gazillion ways. What is one way? What's a way that you've experienced that one can learn for themselves? How, and are we talking about our own personal values, right? Personal values versus the company values. How best can I understand what my own filters are? Because even if a company lays them out, right? So I think about identification of those values and then codification. So even if you've done that, and even if we've done, and I have done this very, very explicitly, there's always additional questions. They're like, well, how does this apply to me? Right? Yeah. Like, can you define this further? And I feel like you'll never get all the way. So how do I, as an individual, or perhaps as a leader, encourage my team to understand our own neurological filters?
Yeah. It doesn't happen overnight. That's for darn sure.
What's the quick and easy solution?
What's the quick plug and play that we can use? But yeah. I mean, there are some of these, and that's the fun with neurology, right? Is realizing how neuroplastic we are. And I think this is something where science is finally, we're starting to see that, where we thought for a very long time that our brains after a certain age could no longer change. And now we're realizing that the majority of cortices that we have in our brain are incredibly neuroplastic, which means that we can really be engineering our minds in whatever way we want, which is quite exciting up until around 80 years old. And then it starts to get a little bit complicated. So we have lots of time ahead of us. So in terms of looking at our filters, the easiest way is to look very quickly at how you make decisions. Our unconscious mind makes probably upwards of 80% of our decisions. So your conscious mind only becomes aware of those once you're already taking that action.
Right.
Which can be quite disconcerting for some people, but here we are. Being able to look and say, okay, when I'm in a stressful situation and I need to just like make a call, what are those things that I go over really quickly in order to make that call? You start to realize what's most important to you. So for example, if somebody asks you, hey, like, you know, what do you want to do Friday night? Like, very easy example. Or in the sense of a workplace, we could say, hey, you know, do you want to work on this project? Maybe the first thing that comes to mind is, well, like, is this going to add more time to my plate? Okay, in which case, the something that you value is how much time you're spending at work and maybe how much time you're spending doing outside of work things. Or maybe your first question is, how hard is it going to be? Well, that could probably indicate what your risk tolerance is. So maybe it's something a little bit, you know, one of your filters is this really risky or is it not risky, right? So you start to figure out, okay, what is my guttural response? Like, what is that just initial step forward that I take when, you know, when somebody pushes you and you step forward with the right foot? Like, what is that? What foot is going forward when somebody's asking me a quick question? You can start to then from there break down what things are coming into play really quickly first. Those are usually your key filters that will apply to everything in life. So that's like a fast way to start to determine what your filters are. And then you can actually change them. And that's a whole other practice that takes a little bit more time.
Is it possible that I don't want to put you on the spot, but so I'm going to ask it in this way, which is it possible that there is a list of these kind of hypothetical questions that one could sort of a battery of questions that you can put to yourself? So the first one you're asking is, Are you interested in being involved in this project?
Yeah.
So are there, could we assemble if it doesn't already exist? I mean, and would it be effective to kind of say, okay, we're going to determine for our team where our own filters and values are. Here are some questions, and I want you to think about what foot you put forward.
Yeah, definitely. I think the questions are going to change for every company. But it is, yeah, it's definitely easy to put forward, you know, 5 or 6 questions, and they don't even have to be specific to that. They can really be specific to the person. So, you know, you can say in terms of like, how do you decide which friends to keep? Like that can be a question too. Or, you know, what do you do? How do you spend your time, or what's most important to you in terms of how you spend your time? Right. And these are questions you can bring into a one-on-one. So again, going back to your thing around leaders and their interactions with individuals. So you can have a monthly one-on-one where you rotate through this, maybe quarterly, you ask a couple of these questions, because one, we're constantly evolving. So somebody's that foot that they put forward, you know, in year one, maybe in year two or three, is going to be different as they've learned and evolved. But yeah, there's a number of different ways to test that out. And I think it's just being able to sit down and realistically any question that you ask that requires somebody to make a decision, right? So that doesn't require a yes or no answer, is going to show you very, very quickly what filters or what priorities or what values that they have in place already.
Okay. So how do I assess or determine the gap between, or if there's a gap, right? Like, of course, like my personal values are not going to be what, you know, the executive team decided the corporate values are. Like, that's just, you know, and I'm always encouraging my clients to, you know, do kind of more specific, meaningful, you know, very particular kinds of state, particular kind of intents and priorities through their values. And so that means it's going to be less and less likely that it's going to be yours. So there's going to be some kind of gap. How do you deal with that? Or is that something to deal with? How do I understand? Because we're using the same word, values, personal and corporate. How are those different? And how, and is it a problem? When does it become a problem if there's a gap? Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing that I struggle with words a lot in, like, I think I put too much emphasis on semantics a lot of the time. It's probably because of my background, but I struggle a lot when we say corporate values, mostly just because when we think of values, like that word, we're thinking of our morals and ethics, right? And most often values in a company aren't used to make moral decisions. They're used to make business decisions. And so ultimately I consider them to be more guidelines, right? So it's like your company values could be, we move fast, we prioritize fun, we, you know, we're innovative, whatever, like these types of things. So it has nothing really to do with your morals or ethics. It's allowing somebody who's working autonomously to say, if I have to make a decision and I can't speak to anybody on my team, like nobody's available, and I just have to work autonomously and make this call, I can go back to these values or guidelines. And I know that whatever make a decision I make, as long as they're in line with these values, it's going to be, you know, approved by the company, or I'm not going to get some kind of terrible consequence or lose my job or
whatever. Ostracized from the community.
Ostracized from the community, 100%. So at the end of the day, that's the first thing I usually do is say, like, let's just reframe this a little bit so that people understand the values you're creating for your business are just the guidelines that ultimately help people understand behaviors and then understand how to make decisions, you know, in a really quick situation or under stress. In terms of the gap, it's really going to differ for each person. At the end of the day, and we all have different perspectives on this, my perspective is that you can be like your values can misalign, right? So the way that you make decisions or the things that you prioritize, they can be relatively different from how the business does it. Yeah. Because ultimately your head's not the one that's going to roll if the business goes under. Like, yes, you'll lose your job, but you can go find another one. But like, unless you're one of the co-founding team members, you don't necessarily have that alignment in order to still be an effective part of the team or do those kind of things. Whereas if your true values, right, like your morals and ethics misalign with the company, then ultimately you should not be sticking around, because at a certain point you'll be in too much conflict with yourself.
Right? If the morals and ethics, your personal morals and ethics conflict with the company's morals and ethics, not necessarily what they've called values.
Exactly.
The morals and ethics. I really appreciate the teasing apart of this, because it really is something that is difficult to, like, to think about. You're like, it's just not possible that they're that what you've written is the same as what I've written. And what I think we've uncovered here is that just because we use the same word does not mean it's the same thing.
Exactly. 100%.
Tell me your perspective on, let's go back to this being part of the community as kind of a definition, inherent definition of success. What have you observed the shift since the pandemic has been with organizations and this conceit of community or maybe lack thereof? It's pretty broad and open, so have at it.
Yeah. No, it's funny you bring this up because I mean, the pandemic, I think, was difficult on all of us in a variety of different ways. But what was interesting for me is that in my undergrad, I took a medical anthropology course where we did case studies on previous pandemics and epidemics and like all of these different things to understand the anthropological side of it. So, and how the role anthropology plays in it. So for me, when COVID happened, I just sat there and I was like, oh, I've actually kind of been trained on how to analyze what's happening.
I know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, exactly. It became a bit of a weird, messed up case study. But yeah, ultimately, so there's two different ways that I look at the changes that happened to that. The first is that most often, especially in North American culture, the cues that we take to tell us that we are in or out of a community are visual, because we're reading people's micro expressions, right? So we can tell if somebody is unhappy, even if we don't know it's happening, our unconscious mind can pick up on, is this person dissatisfied? Is this person, you know, like, are they taken aback by something? Are they shocked? Whatever. So we can read those, which means that when we're in the workplace, we can tell really quickly if we're on the in or if we're on the out. The second we go fully virtual, it removes, firstly, a lot of our access to those visual cues because we're not constantly on Zoom meetings. Now, Zoom fatigue is a whole other thing where we spend too much time in meetings, but, you know, in theory, you're not constantly seeing each other all the time, which means that you don't have these cues. And so we actually have to start developing our senses in other ways. Some of them can be our feeling around how things happen. It could be the tone of somebody's voice, right? So there's all of these different things that our minds had to learn how to develop and how to heighten in order to start making up for the fact that we had less visual cues to tell us, are we in or are we out? So that was one thing that I think for a lot of people took, like they got, you know, taken aback by that, because it was, well, how do I know if I've messed up? Really, I mean, ultimately, that's the question that we want
that's
to answer.
The like, that's the question we're always asking. How do did I screw up? Am I?
Because
that's the primal fear. I'm going to be 100%. Ostracized from the community. Right?
And then
so that's
to,
why that's painful.
Exactly. So once you've taken that away, that being said, like I said, our brains are very neuroplastic. We evolve very, very quickly because survival is still very important. And so you start to automatically start to heighten those. So then it comes into the other part of community, which is this question around belonging and what constitutes belonging. Do you need to see people on a regular basis in order to feel like you belong? Well, what we're discovering is not necessarily, right? And there's a lot of ways to still be a part of this community, even though you feel very distant from everybody. And I think that's where a lot of HR leaders struggle, because we're saying, well, we need to recreate all of this community that we had in the workplace, as opposed to looking at it and saying, what does community and what does belonging look like in a virtual world, which is where our world is really moving, even without the pandemic. It just made us get there faster, but we would have gotten there eventually. And so for me, it's that sense of, that's where that base and knowing who you are becomes even more important. What's going to happen is, I think we're seeing a lot more people form their smaller scale communities in a larger workplace, right? So whereas before you might have felt part of that larger community, now you're feeling part of more of a, like, specific to your tech team, or you and the sales team feel closer, or maybe there's a couple of colleagues from different teams, but you all have this thing that brings you together. So we're starting to see a lot of those little clusters that are happening more and more. But yeah, I think that's the thing that's going to take longer. Our brain's adapted. Our brain has always been able to adapt really, really fast, but that feeling of belonging is very emotionally driven, and that takes longer to mature. And so I would say that's what HR people and leaders in general are going to be struggling with and starting to learn and adapt to, is what does belonging in a community look like if we're not physically in that community? And we feel like we're kind of, like, we're outside of it, because for the longest time, community was defined by this space that we're in. And so if we're not sharing a communal space, because now we're in the metaverse, right? Now we're, I mean, it's just like completely expansive. If we don't have that shared space, well, now how do we define the boundaries of our community? How do we define the boundaries of our belonging? And so I think it's a very esoteric and very philosophical question that we have to ask. Yeah. But I think it's an important one to start digging into is like, how do we define belonging for ourselves? And I think that's something that a lot of leaders, especially in a globally distributed world, you know, that gets even more nuanced because every culture defines belonging differently too.
So many threads to pull on. Okay, let's continue to take it on that sort of larger scale, which is there is some language and thinking that kind of Facebook relationships or online relationships aren't a real community, right? Like there is this dialogue around that that's like, well, you need to be seeing people in person. So what are we getting wrong about that? And I think it is difficult to have, meaningful, deep relationships online, but you just told me that it's possible to have community remotely. What are we getting wrong? How can we learn from that to improve how we are continuing to stay in community at work?
Yeah. I don't have all the answers. unfortunately.
That is okay.
Yeah. It's a little hit to the ego to say that, but you know, here we are. This is part of my new era. I think, yeah. So yes, 100%. I believe that we still have this beautiful community in a virtual world. Realistically, we don't have a choice, right? We're going to have to figure out how to do it. One of the things is, so like I said, this figuring out what belonging means in this new era, part of it is understanding ultimately what comes down to creating a community. It's shared behaviors and attitudes, and it's trust, right? Because ultimately, if you have a community where there's no trust, then they're not actually instrumental to your survival, because at any moment they could stab you in the back. And so we need to have trust in order to feel that belonging. Can you build trust without being in a physical space? Yes. How do you build trust? Well, in North America, trust is usually built through task-based relationships. In other cultures, it's more experiential-based. So for example, we can, you see this a lot in the military as well, where it's like, we've been in the trenches, right? Like you hear that. It's funny how much military jargon gets used in the workplace. I don't know if that's a whole other podcast episode. But
we'll do another episode on that. Yeah.
We need boots on the ground. But it's like if you've been in the trenches together, it's very experiential. And so you build this bond. In most North American workplaces, we're building, or even like, social relationships, we're building trust through working through something together. So it could be, for example, you work with your colleague on a certain project, you see that they're capable, they kept up on their deadlines, whatever. We determine that as trustworthy. And so then we'll build that connection. Do you need to be in the same physical space for that? Not at all. But do you need to be aware of that's how you build trust in order for it to be effective? 100%. And so I think that's where, again, it comes back to the space, but even just being able to say, how do we build trust as a team? And what are the ways that we can do that virtually is going to be one way to do that. Another way is, how do we build connection? So how you build connection is usually linked to your communication style. Do we have shared context between us? If we have shared context, then we can build that greater connection because we can communicate with a higher level of assumed context. So there's a lot less explicit communication, right? So for example, if you're talking to me versus talking to your parent, the conversation that you're going to have with your parent or your sibling or a best friend or a partner is going to be very, very different because there's a lot of stuff that you don't actually have to say explicitly. You both just have this context, and so you can kind of pinpoint it really quickly. Whereas you and I, you're going to have to share explicitly a lot more context, which makes it clear to me that we don't have as intimate of a connection. So the greater the shared context, the greater the connection can be built. Well, in a workplace, how do you create this shared context? You document things, right? You have SOPs, you have clear structures, you have clear policies so that everybody is reading the same things. You define words. Like, I'm a big proponent of having a dictionary for your workplace to say, how are we operationalizing, right? How are we using words like efficiency, like performance? Because it's like, these are words that we spit out all the time and we don't realize that we all have very, very, very different definitions. If we can do is something as simple as just aligning on what that is, that creates one link of shared context. If we can do that multiple times, now we have a huge base of shared context. Well, we've created connection. And when we have that connection, we can start to build trust. And when we have trust, we can start to build community. We've done all of that without ever sitting in the same office space.
So yeah, there is quite a thread of thinking and action around a lot of these distributed organizations around documentation of, you know, how we do things around here, right? And I completely agree with you about that language piece. As a matter of fact, that's the way that I think about or caution leaders about their values, because they can say a word, but really it could be filled with any sort of meaning, right? So the Nike swoosh, being a designer at heart, the Nike swoosh, right? It's a logo. What does it mean? I don't know. It kind of has an upward dynamic thing, but I don't really know what it means, only through decades of that company filling it with meaning. So when you say, oh, we are collaborative, or, you know, we're worthy of trust, or we bring the donuts, whatever it might be. I don't know what that means. Even if you think, you know, it's like we work efficiently. Okay. Well, there's all sorts of ways we can do that. And so to me, what you're describing, this the workplace dictionary, as it's so appropriate for like an anthropologist to say that, right? So as antiquated as a dictionary sounds, it seems like if we're able to codify more, then we can build context faster. Mm-hmm. And so that would be, I would immediately think, okay, your onboarding program has to include all of that context so that you can get up and running quicker, because everybody's being asked to like get on board and start, you know, start creating that value. And that's one of the things that I have been thinking about and seeing happen, which is how do we get people up and moving quicker and through these projects? Cause it's just going to continue to do that. And, It just makes so much sense to think about documentation of all these things. And then we can start to think about, okay, what are the tools we're going to use? That's how we create shared context. And then I will, the last thing is I'll go back to that idea about trust around tasks. Mm-hmm. And at work, we have the opportunity to do that. And we suss that out very quickly with people who, you know, are or are not. And I'm going to then bring it back to that point about, you know, online social communities. Then perhaps the problem is that we're not invested in anything together. All we're doing is just commenting on things back and forth.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder if the kind of the Discord servers of the world, where we come together with a shared context, but then are maybe working on a project together. What we need to do is something together. And this is for a whole nother thread, a whole nother episode, but what are all the ways, I'll just ask the question, what are all the ways that we can engage with others online, socially, on projects that are hobbies? They're not work, or that maybe they are work. Right. And that starts to feel like, oh yeah, that kind of feels like the right direction in some way. All right. We're gonna leave it there. Samantha Stillwell, she is the startup anthropologist on TikTok. Go find her there. You can find her and her work at culturedynamicendswithaq.com. thank you for taking us through the neurology and anthropology lenses to understand the way that we work. We obviously just scratched the surface, but this was so, so incredibly interesting. I'm just going to be thinking about this for the rest of the day, probably the rest of my life, but definitely the rest of the day. Thank you, Samantha, for coming on Great Mondays Radio.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Josh. This has been so fun.
Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio. Hey, if you want to be a guest, head over to radio.greatmondays.com. And if you think this episode was interesting and your friends and fans would enjoy it, please share on social media. And if you want to get more people to understand the power of company culture in business today, please rate and review Great Mondays Radio on your podcast feed. It really helps us reach more people. If you want to hear more candid conversations with culture leaders, subscribe to Great Mondays Radio. I'd love to connect with you. Find me on LinkedIn at AKA Josh Levine, on YouTube at Great Mondays, and you can always email me, josh@greatmondays.com. Find out more about our work with hypergrowth technology and social enterprise organizations at greatmondays.com. I'm Josh Levine. Thanks for listening to Great Mondays Radio.